Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Pensions Experts Fortnightly Podcast. As the country begins to move out of lockdown, our ambition is to make it to the end of this program without contracting even the need to talk about coronavirus. So to that end, our topics this week will be firstly, innovation. The regulator is set to issue guidance on so-called capital-backed endgame deals. We'll ask what space exists for bespoke arrangements to be reached and whether we are likely to see more of them, after which we suffer insolvency, not directly, for we are all fortunate enough to remain in gainful employment, but by looking at new insolvency laws introduced by Parliament and at what they mean for defined benefit schemes. Finally, allegations of naughty behaviour have been levelled against a number of LGPS authorities whose investments in arms manufacturers and other supposedly nefarious assets are deemed by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and others to be unethical. My name is Benjamin Mercer. I'm a reporter at Pensions Experts. We are delighted to be joined today by perhaps the pensions expert, Malcolm McLean, currently an independent pensions consultant, who my editor hopes has not forgotten more about this subject than I will ever know, and also by the inestimable Penny Koger, partner at Irwin Mitchell, whose dual purpose today is to explain the law to us whilst making sure we do not fall foul of it. We begin with innovative arrangements then. We reported last week on a pension scheme reaching a capital-backed endgame deal which uses third-party investors to back the cost of a buyout. It was hard to actually discover very much by way of specifics about this deal because the press release concerned an awful lot of things which it turned out were the subject of confidentiality agreements. But I thought, Penny, if I can begin with you, we maybe take a broad look at this. I gather the regulator was aware of the deal. It was decided in this case that the deal didn't require clearance. The regulator has said they will issue guidance, and groups like Clara and the Pension Superfund are still awaiting their guidance. I was wondering if you could give us a sense of what the guidance is at the moment surrounding these unusual arrangements. Do such groups like the Pension Superfund need to wait for extra guidance, or does the law allow them to proceed regardless?
The difference between this capital back journey that was announced last week and the super funds is that we're told that this is an investment decision that's been made by the trustees, so there was no need for regulator clearance. We're told that the assets were invested to target the cost of a buyout at an agreed date with suitable returns on the capital, with a hedge out of inflation and interest rates. Of course, with current concern about volatility with COVID and the prospect of negative inflation, it's difficult to know quite how solid these assumptions are. And then we're told that the scheme draws cash from the structure to pay the benefits until it reaches buyout. It has been done through Portune Capital, which is not subject to any capital adequacy requirements or Solvency II requirements, unlike the super funds that we're more used to. So that means that as regards Portune Capital, we don't know whether it's going to be there in 5 to 8 years' time, how solid it is, what's in it for them. Whereas there's been a much more public discussion about the Claras and the other super fund arrangements. We broadly know what's in it for them, and we have some idea for how any surplus might be used on winding up. And we don't know what this particular scheme rules might say about sharing surplus with its members.
I wonder what your opinion is on this deal or the regulatory guidance issue more broadly, Malcolm.
Well, this is part of the thing that we've been talking about now for some time, the whole question of an endgame strategy for DB private sector schemes. And we've seen in the past the most obvious way of buying out a scheme through the insurance arrangement, such as a bulk annuity deal. But there has been, I think, a growing interest in the use of alternative consolidation mechanisms. That would be either merging schemes or transferring liabilities to a third party. I can understand the regulator being a little bit concerned about this new type of business model, which has got certain possible downsides to it, and that's something the regulator will want to satisfy itself of, because at the end of the day, it's the consumer, it's the members that could lose out as a result of this, and I don't think anybody wants that to happen. As regards consolidation, I'm a little bit confused about this, because my understanding initially was the government were quite keen on consolidation, but yet they have left it out of the pension schemes bill, which is currently stuck somewhere in Parliament because of the pandemic priorities. And it was a little bit of a surprise that they've left it out of that. So we don't really know where we're going there. There's nothing to stop consolidation taking place at the moment, as I understand it. But I think we all think there needs to be some sort of regulatory parameters laid down for this to work properly, hence the need for something to be produced in legislation. But it's not going to happen immediately, and it may be that we're stuck on this for some time.
In the absence of government legislation, regulation, or additional guidance from the regulator, how much space do schemes and companies involved in dealing with them have to almost pursue their own agenda? I suppose that question is really about what allowance is there for innovation, because obviously the Pension Super Fund has been waiting for guidance for a while. Then out of the blue, this capital-backed venture just emerges, again, apparently without guidance regarding it. So is it just the case that these consolidators are waiting just to be sure, but they could in theory act if they wanted to?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way of putting it. While the consolidators don't actually require a change of the law in order to separate schemes from their sponsors, it's thought that in most cases, many will be reluctant to proceed without the ability to point to specific regulatory standards, providing assurance that the risk to members has been adequately mitigated. So I think we're all thinking in terms of the members here as to what is the best way to proceed. And I think that's a good thing, actually. So I imagine that most of the consolidators will, for the moment, want to hold off on this, but it may well be that some of them will want to fire ahead anyway.
And of course, the trustees are concerned. If they know that there's going to be regulatory guidance out there that hasn't been issued, they won't necessarily want to push ahead until they've seen that guidance in case it falls foul of it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. It's not just down to the consolidator, obviously. It's to the trustees themselves who have a fiduciary role here. They've got a responsibility to make sure that whatever happens is in the best interest of the members. And that will be something that they will have to ask themselves many questions about before proceeding, in the absence of some sort of regulatory framework for controlling these things.
So I suppose then that leads us nicely on moving away from changes we are yet to see in the law, the changes which are almost certainly going to happen in the law. Recently, the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy introduced the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Bill with potential implications for defined benefit schemes, which, as I understand it, are typically unsecured creditors. As a complete layman to this, I was wondering, Penny, if you could explain to me what it is about this new bill which impacts DB schemes, and what to look out for when studying this.
So I think the first thing to point out is that this bill is going to be fast-tracked through Parliament, and they want it to become law by the end of June on the basis that the government, and I think there's all party consensus really, that the bill is basically good for UK PLC. From the pensions perspective, we do want joined-up legislation with some dovetailing over directors, over their new proposed duties to pension schemes as regards the pension schemes bill that's sort of sitting there languishing. And the moral hazard rules, again, which have to interact quite carefully with the new insolvency regimes. Or what impact this may all have for pension trustees, who are often a group or a company's largest creditor, sometimes secured, sometimes unsecured, outside of the banks. So, I mean, we were just getting to grips with the legal scope of the regulator's moral hazard powers through various court cases. And we're now going to have to view them all from a different prism. Where we are is that this bill makes changes, two temporary changes and three more fundamental changes to the current solvency regime. The first temporary change is to the winding up petition regime, and it basically stops winding up petitions being put in place for the next 3 months or so. This has a relevance to DB pension schemes because, as we all agree, if the pension trustees are the largest unsecured creditor of a company, then sometimes those pension trustees are advised to issue a winding up petition against their sponsoring employer if the position has reached such a stage that the company doesn't seem able to support the group any longer. So those types of petitions can no longer be put in place by pension trustees. A further change, which is a temporary change, but I think just worth mentioning very briefly, is a suspension of liability for wrongful trading. And it means that a director can continue running a company, even if there is concern that the company is technically insolvent. And this, I think, is just helpful in terms of keeping businesses going. But there is liability there that continues for misfeasance. So directors still have to be careful if they are going to keep a potentially insolvent company going, that they don't fall foul of their misfeasance duties. And the government has to be careful over this cliff edge position, whereby once that 3 month or 6 month temporary period comes to an end, the directors are then straight back in the firing line for wrongful trading, and trustees start pointing the finger and saying, actually, you know you're really wrongfully trading here, and we know you are, and if you don't start taking matters more seriously, we will potentially encourage the book to be thrown to you. So those are the two temporary measures, and then we have three longer term measures. We have a fancily named a new gateway moratorium that allows companies to consider and implement rescue options. And under this, there is a moratorium holiday. So there's a payment holiday for all of the debts of the company incurred before the moratorium, except one thing that's included is wages or salary, which you'd expect pension contributions to be included in the detail of it all. And this just gives the company a breathing space, the directors a breathing space to helpfully turn that company round. So I think that would be a good thing for pension schemes, pension trustees, because, pension trustees are not meant to be in the business of necessarily pushing their sponsoring employer to the edge. But I think the one that's caused the controversy on the pension side of things is something that's called a cross-class cram down. It's a new restructuring procedure to cram down, to force basically a rescue plan across a company's dissenting junior classes of creditors, which could include these pension trustees. So this is the bit where I think lawyers have been concerned that pension trustees may be potentially forced to agree to a restructuring proposal that may not necessarily be in the best interests of that pension scheme. But it's worth noting that actually, if the pension trustees feel that the proposal, the compromise, is brought back to the court for final approval, so there is an opportunity there for the pension trustees to make a representation if they feel they are worse off. And the court can only override the dissenting pension trustees, say, if the court decides that dissenting class would not be any worse off under the arrangements than what's most likely would happen in the alternative. Mm. Here, I mean, usually, if those pension trustees are unsecured creditors, if they get something out of the arrangement, they're getting something more than they might otherwise potentially have got under a full insolvency, where they may just get a few pence in the pound. So there's a potential for those pension trustees to get more under this arrangement.
Finally, then, we're moving on from changes definite to changes that at least some people desire. We reported on May 29th research carried out by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which showed that 33 local government pension scheme funds have investments totaling more than £2 billion in a variety of ethically dubious companies, including arms manufacturers and companies blacklisted by the United Nations Human Rights Council for alleged activities in Gaza and the West Bank. Additionally, as we reported today, I believe it was, the university's superannuation scheme has announced it's to divest from tobacco and arms manufacturers and some fossil fuel companies. Penny, there's quite a clear ESG motive when it comes to divesting from fossil fuels. Many of their producers have fared especially badly in this current crisis, but issues like arms, tobacco, and questions around involvement in Israel presumably come under what we might call ethical investment, which, as I understand it, is distinct. When it comes to making investment decisions which is, shall we say, non-financially based, what's the law currently? I understand that there are the Law Commission's two tests, which maybe you could explain for us.
This is very much a hot topic at the moment. We had the Supreme Court reaching a decision just on the 29th of April 2020 about how local authority pension schemes, administering authorities, should invest for the LGPS. But what the Supreme Court did do is it helpfully endorsed the Law Society's report, 2014 report on the fiduciary duties of investment intermediaries. And so it's agreed that on ESG matters, non-financial factors may only be taken into account by LGPS administrators if the trustees had good reason to think the scheme members would share the concern and the decision should not involve a risk of significant financial detriment to the fund. And the Supreme Court says, well, this reconciles the differences there were with the old 1985 Cowan and Scargill case about the extent to which trustees can take account of financial factors in investment. I mean, what I would say is I think we're in a different investment world as regards ESG now in 2020 than even 2016, when the government tried to push through its policy on disinvestment for ESG matters. But equally, I think it's still very difficult, I think, for LGPS administrators, trustees and scheme members on DB to know quite how to satisfy those Law Commission guidelines. Because what it says is the trustees have to have good reason to think the scheme members would share the concern. And of course, members can have a huge range of views, especially over ESG. It means different things to different people. And people have their own ESG interests that they want to prioritise. And some actually don't want to prioritise any ESG interests. They just want maximum return on their investments. And when you think about it, these public sector employees in the LGPS itself are 5.9 million employees, and trying to find some policy that everybody will agree to, or even the majority would agree to, is fundamentally, I think, quite difficult. And then the second rule that the Law Commission laid down that the Supreme Court has endorsed is the decision over ESG should not involve a risk of significant financial detriment to the fund. And the amount of crystal ball gazing, especially with the pandemic and the volatility that's been introduced there, and now with the US rioting, I mean, I think it makes it very difficult, I think, for trustees or the LGPS scheme administrator or any investment advisor really to be able to judge it in that way.
Yeah, there are certainly specifics to be ironed out. But Malcolm, if I could ask you just in quite a broad sense, is your impression that this newfound focus on the ethics or the morality of pensions investments is something which is almost quite a modern phenomenon? Is our understanding of the role of pensions and the morality of their investments changing? Is it somewhat keener now than perhaps it was in the past?
Well, I think there's been a big change in attitudes to ethical investment across the world, rather than just in the context of pension schemes. At one time, trustees would take the view that they had to get the best possible deal out of their investment strategy for the members. And that often meant excluding ethical investments altogether. I think we've moved on quite a bit from that now, and it's often seen that ethical investments can, over a longer term, produced good returns and satisfy the moral considerations as well. So I think things are different now than they were, but there's still a problem here as to getting the best deal and investing in good areas, shall we say, which will act for the benefit of not only the members, but the country and if not the world as a whole.
Yeah, I think an evolving area is how I'd probably define it, just based on the little work I've done on it so far.
Evolving areas often evolve in a way that you don't expect as well. So we'll have to see how that works out.
Absolutely, watching it very closely.
It's a bit like the end game we were talking about before. The end games are really long games, because in some cases you might be talking about 35 years before the end game comes to an end. So these are long-term issues, really.
That then is all we've got time for. So thank you to our guests, Malcolm and Penny. Thank you to our listeners, whoever you are. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and we hope you'll join us again.